be out there and lead a full life at home and at work. Men didn't have a movement behind them. And were hurt that they're losing their edge and want more from women at home to compensate. And they're not getting it because women are exhausted.
That isn't Frances Fox Piven, who Glenn Beck is attacking. That's the wife of Richard Wolff. I'm sorry to introduce her that way. Her last name is Fraud, F-R-A-U-D, no relation to Freud. Psychotherapist, also living in Massachusetts. Interesting to note that statistics that I've seen are that this remedy of disparity between what women earn and what men earn has not come because women are earning more. It's because men are earning less. So everybody's going down. Thanks for listening. Opinions of the speakers. Apologize for, anything I need to apologize for. Ask me about it, and I'll see whether it's one of the ones that I would. If you're listening closely, you know what I'm talking about. Opinions are those of the speakers. The labor hour's in the house. Dave's not here. Hi, Dave. Hope you're listening. Anyway, have a good afternoon.
We're not a working. Hello, folks, and welcome to the January 15th, 2011 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air on WEFT 90.1 FM radio in Champaign and webcast worldwide at weft.org. The views and opinions expressed in this hour of programming are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinion of WEFT's management or board of directors. Now here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is being brought to you by you, the listeners of WEFT, and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that they enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you, the listeners of WEFT, and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
All right, thanks, Tom. I'm your host, Bob Polesny, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us, and later in the hour, the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's poem for this week is from his book, Live for Something or Die for Nothing, and is entitled, Whatever Became of Tom Joad. And also with us here today is Jason Kozlowski. He will have some labor news for us and some commentary. And Bill Gorell is just getting in the studio here, and he'll also have some news and commentary for us. And so now here's Tom to kick off this week's Workers' Interest News.
With the close of 2010, the pace of home foreclosures dropped significantly as a result of revelations that thousands of foreclosure documents may have been improperly prepared. Lenders and mortgage servicers imposed delays on foreclosure processes in October after reports in September that some servicers did not follow legal procedures in tens of thousands of foreclosures. Mortgage servicers report they are resuming some stalled foreclosures, but RealtyTrack estimates that up to 250,000 may have been delayed by the controversy. Those foreclosures will likely be restarted and added to the numbers in early 2011. In addition to taking longer to make sure all paperwork is legally correct, mortgage companies may be slowing foreclosures so they don't glut the market with homes for sale, which would depress prices significantly. They may also be delaying foreclosures to avoid the cost of maintaining properties while others remain unsold. In December 2010, bank repossessions nationwide totaled 69,847, which was down 24% from December of 2009, but up 4% from November of 2010. For the whole year of 2010, some 2.9 million U.S. properties received foreclosure filings, a record high, and up 2% from 2009 nationwide. Throughout last year, one in every 45 homes received at least one foreclosure filing during the year.
The National Labor Relations Board approved a settlement on January 10, nullifying the results of the historic October 22nd union election at Jimmy John's, putting victory back on the table for the nation's first-ever union-enfranchised fast food. The settlement validates workers' claims that franchise owners Mike and Rob Mulligan were able to squeak out an 87-85 victory in the election, defeating the Industrial Workers of the World's efforts to represent 10 Minneapolis-area Jimmy John's workers, only by resorting to unlawful tactics including threatening a wage freeze, intentionally fabricating rumors that the union engaged in sabotage, retaliating against union supporters, and numerous other labor rights violations. With the tainted election results nullified, the union is asking the franchise owners to negotiate over its, quote, 10-point program for justice at Jimmy John's, end quote, which is a comprehensive package of reforms that would bring respect, dignity, and democracy to the fast food workplace. Based around benefits that workers in many other industries take for granted, the program is the response of Jimmy John's workers to their most pressing problems on the job. These demands include sick days, improved job security, guaranteed work hours, reasonable pay increase and regular raises, improved harassment policies, other basic job benefits, and the establishment of a system of shop committees giving workers a democratic voice within the company. Under the NLRB settlement, Jimmy John's must cease engaging in a wide range of unlawful anti-union activities, post notices informing employees of the company's new commitment to obeying the law, and host a series of mandatory employee meetings in which a representative of the NLRB will read the notices in the presence of the company owner.
Bob. Okay, it's not a good week to be a MySpace employee. Just a day after it was announced that MySpace would lay off nearly half its staff, News Corp admitted that it's considering selling the site. News Corp is assessing a number of possibilities, including a sale, a merger, and a spin-out, a spokesman for MySpace said. The process has just started. Chief Executive Mike Jones delivered the news to employees on Wednesday at a company-wide meeting about MySpace's future. On Tuesday, the former social networking behemoth announced it would cut its staff by 47%. News Corp famously bought MySpace in 2005 for $580 million, but it hasn't exactly been a cash cow for the media company. In the last quarter, the segment of News Corp that owns MySpace lost $156 million. The layoffs, which would affect about 500 people, were expected, however, especially as executives had called the losses not acceptable in November. According to Bloomberg News, if a spinoff is the solution to MySpace's woes, News Corp will help fund the venture. News Corp would take a more entrepreneurial approach to MySpace, bringing in partners, privatizing, and offering stock options to employees. It says, we're considering a number of strategic options for the business, News Corp spokesperson Julie Henderson said. Tom?
Rather than the usual date of April 15th, taxpayers will have until midnight April 18th to file their 2010 tax returns. The filing deadline is being delayed because the District of Columbia will be observing Emancipation Day on April 15th. Taxpayers requesting extensions will have until October 17th to file their returns. Emancipation Day marks the occasion when President Abraham Lincoln signed into law a bill outlawing slavery in the District of Columbia. That was on April 16th, 1862, actually more than 8 months before Lincoln signed the U.S. Emancipation Proclamation, which eventually led to all slaves being freed. The IRS expects to process more than 140 million individual income tax returns this year. Most taxpayers can fill out their returns and file them as soon as they receive all their tax documents from employers, banks, and other financial institutions. However, some taxpayers will have to wait until mid to late February to file their returns because of late changes to the 2010 tax law passed by Congress in December. The IRS said it needs more time to reprogram its processing systems to take the new law into account. Jason?
Courtesy of the New York Times. United Automobile Workers Union this year is renewing its efforts to organize workers at plants that foreign automakers operate in the United States and will portray the companies that resist as quote-unquote human rights violators, the union's president said Wednesday. UAW President Bob King said the companies would be better off morally and financially if they allowed the workers to organize. The union, he said, has changed its philosophy and could help the companies become more competitive, not less. Last week, the UAW released a list of 11 principles for what it termed fair union elections that it wants foreign-based manufacturers to adopt, and said it had set aside $60 million from its strike fund to spend on organizing efforts within the plants of those companies. The principles are aimed at giving workers the chance to decide whether they want to unionize without intimidation, fear of repercussions from either side, or misleading information. Toyota, Honda, Hyundai, Kia, Nissan, and BMW all have plants in the United States, primarily non-union ones, and mostly in the South, away from areas like the Midwest where unions hold greater influence. UAW represented plant in California that was operated by a joint venture of Toyota and GM closed last year, and the union has been pressuring Toyota to hire its former workers when the plant reopens to build electric vehicles in a partnership now with Tesla. Volkswagen is building a plant in Tennessee. In Japan, Toyota Motor Workers Union has more than 60,000 members, Mr. King said. Car makers who operate with unions in their home countries but discourage unionization in the U.S. are treating their American workers like, quote, second-class global citizens, end quote. Bob?
Thanks, Jason. I got a story here about the California Nurses Association and National Nurses United and Kaiser Permanente have tentatively agreed to a new three-year contract, according to both sides. Oakland-based CNA said the tentative deal includes significant improvements for 17,000 registered nurses and nurse practitioners in 21 Kaiser hospitals and 40 medical office buildings and clinics throughout Northern and Central California. Kaiser officials, meanwhile, said they're pleased to have reached a tentative agreement, but can't say more until the deal is ratified by the affected RNs and nurse practitioners. Key features of the collective bargaining agreement include more than 20 professional and economic enhancements, and significantly, no reductions in patient care protections or economic or professional practice standards, CNA said, citing a state law it sponsored that sets minimum nurse-to-patient ratios. But the union was mum on any specifics. It's withholding additional details of the tentative agreement pending ratification votes by Kaiser staffers at 26 sites throughout the region. Those are slated to take place through early February, said a CNA spokesman, Chuck Idelson. Tom?
A growing number of older American workers are professing no desire to retire. After decades of decline, the labor force participation rate of people 65 and older has risen from a low of 10.7% in 1987 to more than 17% currently. Nearly a third of the people aged 65 to 69 are either working or looking for work, and that's up some 20% since the 1980s. People both need and want to be a part of the workforce longer in an era of longer lives, and seniors with incomes feel more secure and spend more in a way that generally boosts the economy. Though some older workers encounter barriers in the labor markets, there is plenty that we as a society can do to encourage our most experienced workers to continue sharing their gifts with the world in a way that is rewarding for them as well as their employers. Baby boomers in particular have a desire to stay engaged and active in the workforce, and in many cases to try their hands at second careers. However, just because people need or want to work, or both, does not mean that staying in the labor force is easy. Surveys of job-seeking seniors have found that rampant age discrimination exists in a lot of companies.
Got that right.
Yeah.
Workers at France's two biggest ports at Marseille and Le Havre held the second day of strike action yesterday out of a planned five in protest at the breakdown of government talks over changes to working conditions. The Marseille and Foss general cargo terminals were blocked, according to Clara Batineau, a spokeswoman for the port. Oil installations weren't affected, she said. However, 19 container vessels canceled plans to stop at the port of Le Havre over the past 24 hours while the docking of five bulk carriers was delayed, the port said in a statement. The CGT, France's biggest port workers union, called a series of strikes that started on June 13th and will run through early January 17th in protest at what it deemed the unacceptable position of the government toward port workers. The government's latest proposals offer less favorable early retirement conditions than previously agreed, the union said in a statement. CGT called on port workers and dockers to strike on alternating days and halt overtime, night and weekend shifts. The union, government, and management of cargo handling companies are negotiating labor contracts under a 2008 law that was aimed at making French harbors more competitive. There's that buzzword again. Under the plan, workers operating equipment such as cranes were to be moved from state-owned ports to privately run cargo handling companies in a bid to make the ships more flexible and work more efficient. Bob?
Okay, a couple more auto-related stories here. This one out of Turin, Italy. Italy's Fiat narrowly won a crucial victory Saturday after workers voted to accept new working conditions at a plant seen as the cornerstone of a 20 billion euro plan to double output in its home country. The final results of a highly contested referendum showed workers at the historic Mirafiori car plant in the northwestern industrial city voted 54.1% in favor of the proposed conditions, according to an official of the FIMCISL union, one of the unions that oversaw the ballot counting. Nearly all of the more than 5,000 workers had cast their vote during the last 2 days under threat from Fiat that it would move production to another country, specifically Poland, I think, in this case, if they didn't accept the conditions. The conditions, which bring more flexibility to everything from shifts and overtime to sick leave and absenteeism, were put to a vote after four of the five major unions came to an agreement with Fiat before Christmas. The vote's favorable outcome will result in Fiat investing 1 billion euros in the plant where Alfa Romeo and Jeep vehicles will be made under a joint venture with its U.S. partner, Chrysler Corporation. Well, Chrysler Group, LLC, nowadays. And in a related note, two big Detroit car makers will announce profit-sharing checks this month for their hourly workers, perhaps the largest in a decade. company officials and industry analysts say. The payouts are expected to top $5,000 at Ford. It says all three Detroit car companies are preparing to negotiate new contracts with the United Auto Workers Union this summer. Hovering over the talks will be the dark days leading up to the federal bailouts of GM and Chrysler in 2009 and the renewed sense of optimism permeating the domestic industry. It says the gap in labor costs between Detroit and the foreign-owned factories in the United States has narrowed considerably. Ford's total labor cost for a worker, a combination of wages, benefits, and pensions, has been reduced by more than 20% and is now about $59 an hour, compared to $56 an hour at Toyota, according to the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And some new ideas about compensation are surfacing. On Tuesday, GM's chief executive, Daniel F. Akerson, suggested that bonuses for hourly workers would be tied to vehicle quality and overall company performance. The UAW union president, Bob King, responded that workers would have an open mind as long as they got a piece of the profits in the new contracts. And the current four-year contracts expire in the fall. And I think we're going to go to a piece of auto-related music titled The 1937 Strike. That was written by David O. Norris and sung by Dan Hall. And this is a song that we were kind of getting to at the end of the show a couple weeks ago when we did, Jason did that great report on the 1937 sit-down strike in Flint, Michigan there. So, 1937.
Packed my last guitar away and started driving home. My head is full of songs and smoking while I drove along. What made me go down Chevrolet, I guess I'll never know. At 1 a.m. the place was lit with amber streetlight glow. Is this the place where brave men stood to corporation power and yelled to the winds, to hell with you, this is the workers' hour. Simple men with work-worn hands and lives not worth a damn formed a line to live or die once the fight began. Is there a truer heart today than those who took a stand? In 1937, cold, the sit-down strike would end. They left their wives and babies alone to face uncertainty and what they earned when spirits burned was passed today to me. And all the fakes who tried to make us go, we stand for right and we'll win this fight, match 'em toe to toe. So bring 'em on, we're waiting here to fight or talk, you choose. And while we hold our brother's hand, the worker will never lose. Is there a truer heart today than those who took a stand? In 1937, cold, the sit-down strike would end. They left their wives and babies alone to face uncertainty, and what they earned when spirits burned was passed today to me. Stories told of all those desperate nights. I wish I could have stood with them to see their wives come down, to stand in line between their men upon this battleground. was here to rally up the crowd. And as long as we still hear the voice of 37 strong, they'll live within and guide our path that leads us ever on. Is there a truer heart today than those who took a stand?
Singing a song written by David O. Norris, 1937. That's all about the sit-down strike in Flint, Michigan. And we're going to go right into a little bit of Hightower Radio here. So I hope you enjoy it. We'll be right back with the Cultural Corner after that with Tom's Poem of the Week. This is Hightower Radio.
By gollies, America is still an exporting powerhouse. In fact, our corporate chieftains have made us number one in exporting America's most precious goods. Our jobs, factories, technologies, and middle-class opportunities. With unemployment and underemployment devastating millions of families in our country, perhaps you've assumed that U.S. corporations aren't hiring these days. Nonsense. They added 1.4 million jobs last year alone, overseas. For example, more than half of Caterpillar's new hires in 2010 were in foreign countries. Many more of this giant's jobs are headed offshore in the near future, for Caterpillar, which was once an iconic American brand, has recently invested in 3 new plants in China. It'll not only manufacture tractors and bulldozers there, but it'll also begin to ship its design work and technology development jobs to China. Likewise, DuPont, once proud of its U.S. workforce, has slashed its number of American employees in recent years while increasing its Asia-Pacific workforce by more than half. Indeed, DuPont no longer considers itself American. We're a global player, sniffs its chief innovation officer. Such homemade brands as Coca-Cola, Dell, and IBM are also among the multitude of corporations abandoning our shores and our middle class. Of course, they still keep their well-appointed headquarters here so the corporation and top executives can continue enjoying all that America has to offer. Calvin Coolidge once asserted that what's good for business is good for America. That was myopic enough, but today's narcissistic CEOs are even more self-serving, declaring that what's good for business is good for business. America be damned. This is Jim Hightower saying, if we're to have a united society, America cannot tolerate such raw selfishness by the privileged few. We can have a plutocracy or a democracy, but not both.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And as Jim Hightower says, what's good for business is good for business. So now we've come to that part of the program, the weekly cultural corner, and Tom's poem of the week is Whatever Became of Tom Joad.
Who has taken time to wonder whatever happened to Tom Joad after that sad and tearful night back when he had to hit the road? His hellhounds hounded him until that night he had to go away, but never got the best of him because he always won the day. He won because his spirit lives in secret shadows of the night. He won because he stood up straight and never was afraid to fight. Just like he told his ma, he is everywhere that hungry folks strive to find a job, to buy some grub, to keep their families alive. Too sadly, he is always there when cops are beating up a guy. He's there when hungry children laugh because they know that supper's nigh. The truest of rebels he was, though but a common man was he. Stand up and yell, old Tom Joad taught, when you have chosen to be free. Nowadays there are too many suffering families like the Joads, searching for their nation's promise as they wander America's roads. And the spirit of old Tom Joad will be riding along with them, constantly reminding them that the dream they seek is not a whim. There'll be a day of fruition, though nobody knows yet just when. But when it finally comes for us, we'll know where Tom's spirit has been. Whatever Became of Tom Joad was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on March 27, 2006, and has been recited at various venues, the most recent being here on the January 15, 2011 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you by WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, Community Radio for East Central Illinois.
Thanks, Tom. And this is just a reminder that you can catch Labor's View television show every Sunday at 4 o'clock on Comcast Cable Channel 6. And that features our usual host, David Johnson, and friend of the show, Jim Iman. He was just on recently. And again, that's Labor's View TV, Sunday afternoons at 4 o'clock on Comcast Cable Channel 6. And I believe Bill's got a public service announcement about an upcoming program on WRFU.
Oh, hi. I have to get back to Facebook. I was just scouring YouTube for cuts from the movie The Grapes of Wrath. I do know, maybe I'll go out and look for a CD. We probably should have.
We're going to play a little cut here as soon as we're done with the public service announcements.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let me get done here. Anyway, Neil Parthen tells us that he and Andrew Hutchinson will be broadcasting another episode of Not Another Sports Show at 2 p.m. on 104.5 FM. If you can't listen live, just search for their podcast in the iTunes store or see the link in, well, in his profile. It is the Labor Negotiation Show. From the impending NFL lockout to the NBA to the unpaid athletes of college sports, tune in or stream on or whatever.
There you go. And just another quick reminder, you can join WEFT and our community partner, the Eastern Illinois Food Bank, for our third annual radio food drive that's going to begin Monday, January 24th. And for every $10 donated to WEFT, the station will donate $1 to the food bank. And the food bank can then work with their contributors to make that $1 turn into $10 worth of food that they can offer up to more than 220 food pantries and other agencies in East Central Illinois. And one in every three of these clients is a child. And we're going to go to a little cut from The Grapes of Wrath. This is Tom Joad talking to his mom, I believe. So.
Oh, yeah, this is what I was looking for.
Yeah. All right, Tom Joad.
Sit down for a minute.
I'd like to stay, Ma. I'd like to be with you and see your face when you and Pa get settled in some nice place. I'd sure like to see you then. But I won't never get that chance, I guess, now.
I could hide you, Tommy.
I know you would, Ma, but I ain't gonna let you. You hide somebody that's killed a guy, and you're in trouble, too.
All right, Tommy. But what do you figure you're going to do?
You know what I've been thinking about? About Casey. About what he said, what he done, about how he died. And I remember all of it.
He was a good man.
I've been thinking about us, too. About our people living like pigs and good, rich land laying fallow. Or maybe one guy with 1,000,000 acres and 100,000 farmers starving. And I've been wondering if all our folks got together and yelled.
Oh, Tommy, they drive you out and cut you down just like they done to Casey.
They're gonna drive me anyways. Sooner or later they get me for one thing if... Sooner or later they get me for one thing if... Sooner or later they get me for one thing if not. Sooner or later they get me for one thing if not. Sooner or later they get me for one thing if not. Sooner or later they get me for one thing if not for another. Sooner or later they get me for one thing if not for another. For one thing if not for another. For one thing if not for another. 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 For another.
Versions of the song on here too.
Sorry about that, folks. Appears we got a skip in that CD, so hopefully we'll get something else going here in a second. And
central scrutinizer interfering with Tom Joad, for goodness sake.
Yes, yes. Somebody's censoring him.
Out of an alehouse into this jailhouse, my body is ruined. They left me here to die. It's 16 pretty maidens to carry my coffin. 16 pretty maidens to sing me a song. Put bunches of roses over my coffin, so I'll look pretty as I ride along. Go tell my baby sister, don't do what I have done. Shun that house, New Orleans, they call rising sun. There is a house in New Orleans.
Okay, we're back. You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and streaming live at weft.org. And you were listening to Odetta from a live concert in 2005, I guess, doing House of the Rising Sun.
Hey, you're blues man, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
What's her last name? Her surname, I guess.
Boy, I couldn't tell you that.
Yeah.
Put me on the spot. Yeah. You know, I probably
could. What's Madonna's last name?
She doesn't have a last name.
How about Prince? What's his real name?
I don't know.
Prince Rogers Nielsen.
Lady Gaga.
All right. Okay.
I struggle with my own last name sometimes.
Let's
Bill.
Not bring these things, these names up in the same, yes. Same conversation with Odetta.
Yes, because we were going to say a few words about Martin Luther King here, and. About how King steadfastly adhered to the principles of nonviolence that had been the foundation of his career. And those principles were put to a severe test in his support of a strike by sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee. And this was King's final campaign before his death. This was all came from a started during a heavy rainstorm in Memphis on February 1st, 1968. Two black sanitation workers had been crushed to death when the compactor mechanism of the trash truck was accidentally triggered. On the same day, in a separate incident also related to the inclement weather, 22 black sewer workers had been sent home without pay, while their white supervisors were retained for the day with pay. About 2 weeks later, on February 12th, more than 1,100 of a possible 1,300 black sanitation workers began a strike for job safety, better wages and benefits, and union recognition. Mayor Henry Loeb, unsympathetic to most of the workers' demands, was especially opposed to the union. Black and white civic groups in Memphis tried to resolve the conflict, but the mayor held fast to his position. As the strike lengthened, support for the strikers within the black community of Memphis grew. Organizations such as COME, which is the Community on the Move for Equality, established food and clothing banks in churches, took up collections for strikers to meet rent and mortgages, and recruited marchers for frequent demonstrations. King's participation in forming a citywide boycott to support the striking workers was invited by the Reverend James Lawson, pastor of the Centenary Methodist Church in Memphis and an advisor to the strikers. Lawson was a seasoned veteran of the civil rights movement and an experienced trainer of activists in the philosophy and methods of nonviolent resistance. At that time, King was involved in planning with other civil rights workers the Poor People's Campaign for Economic Opportunity and Equality. He was also zigzagging by airplane through the eastern United States, meeting, speaking engagements, and attending important social events as head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the SCLC. Nevertheless, King agreed to lend his support to the sanitation workers, and he spoke at a rally in Memphis on March 18th and promised to lead the large march and work stoppage planned for later in the month. Unfortunately, the demonstration on March 28th turned sour when a group of rowdy students at the tail end of the long parade of demonstrators used the signs they carried to break windows of businesses, and looting ensued. The march was halted, the demonstrators dispersed, and King was safely escorted from the scene. About 60 people had been injured, and one young man, a looter, was killed. The episode prompted the city of Memphis to bring a formal complaint in the district court against King, Jose Williams, James Bevel, James Orange, Ralph Abernathy, and Bernard Lee, King's associates in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. The outbreak of violence deeply distressed King. In the next few days, he and fellow SCLC leaders negotiated with the disagreeing factions in Memphis. When assured of their unity and commitment to nonviolence, King came back for another march, at first scheduled for April 6th. In the meantime, U.S. District Judge Bailey Brown granted the city of Memphis a temporary restraining order against King and his associates, but the SCLC's planning and training for a peaceful demonstration had intensified. Lawson and Andrew Young, representing the SCLC, met with the judge April 4th and worked out a broad agreement for the march to proceed April 6th. The details of the agreement would be put into place the next day, April 5th. This was the message that Young conveyed to King as they were getting ready to go out to dinner. Moments later, on that evening of April 4th, 1968, as King stepped out of his motel room to join his colleagues for dinner, he was assassinated. So, Bill, you got some comments, or you got a little bit of audio to play?
Wanted to remind people that Bob just mentioned a few paragraphs ago that it was the Poor People's Campaign. It wasn't the Minority People's or the Black People's or any other people's campaign. It was all the Poor People's. And many people think that perhaps push came to shove when King was talking about the Vietnam War and imperialism, but I think that obviously the situation where he was killed demonstrates that it was his nascent move towards class politics rather than what we would now call identity politics, which in some ways has been the bane of the left opposition in the United States. Over since many years, it has been one way of dividing the working class, and as Jay Gould mentioned, he could hire one half the working class to kill the other half of the working class. And how many people, you know, on jobs, especially on blue collar jobs, you know you're constantly hearing the racist and sexist conversation of your coworkers. And that's one of the things I find hardest about working in construction. You know, I just say pick and choose your fights. There's no point in completely alienating people, but if you can get a little humorous jab in somewhere, you know, please do so, just to make light of the absurd situation of people who have more in common opposing each other instead of opposing those they don't have much in common with, who would be the owning and employing class. And I mean real, I'm not talking about your little guy next door employer, but you know, the big time. We all need to fight together. And if Dr. King would have lived, perhaps there would have been some great grand cross every kind of line class coalition that could have rose in America and been the true majority that it rightfully should be.
Excellent.
Did you want to hear some of this King speech, perhaps?
Yeah, if you think you got it ready queued up there.
I do, and I think he probably says he sings much better than I do.
Yes.
All righty.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. And so just as I say, we aren't going to let any dogs or water hoses turn us around, we aren't going to let any injunction turn us around. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
I don't think any of us can be satisfied in the United States until that war is brought to an honorable end and American soldiers are brought back here to the United States.
One day, we will have to stand before the God of history, and we will talk in terms of things we've done. And it seems that I can hear the God of history saying, that was not enough, but I was hungry, and you fed me not.
Okay, we're back. And those were the words of Martin Luther King. Any comments?
Powerful stuff. I think, Glenn Ford on News from Neptune on a piece that was played before, and it was actually talked about something, interestingly enough, similar to what Bill was talking about as far as sort of, I think, reminding people that of King's legacy, especially later in life, and sometimes it gets forgotten that he'd become a very staunch critic of the war in Vietnam and had increasingly started to make these connections between wars of imperialism, the trajectory of the economy, and really started to coalesce an argument and a critique of just where American money and interests lay. And it was not with the growing working class, who was increasingly struggling in the late 1960s, which is worth remembering, too, that all of this was undercutting the war on poverty, increasing inflation for people, that these stresses started to occur even well before the 70s and 80s. And it was in good part because of Vietnam. And this was something that King was putting his finger on more and more.
Yes.
Well, I was just saying it's easy to forget those things because they are not brought up commonly in the mainstream media. You'll hear that little bit on this one here that is the real prophetic part of the speech, you know, and you will hear I have a dream, but you won't hear the Riverside Church speech.
Yeah,
where a lot of these things were tied together, except here on WEFT, more than likely. I don't think you would even hear it on MSNBC.
No.
You might hear it. Now, somewhere you might hear it, and save in the evenings, it would be 11 a.m. till, I believe, 2 or 3 p.m. here in the Midwest. if you don't like the music that's playing during those times with WEFT, you might try streaming Tom Hartman. He would be playing such things.
Yes, yeah.
That's THOMHARTMANN.com. And say in the evenings you don't care for what's being played on WEFT, you can stream Mike Malloy, who is one of my radio inspirations. And you might like his style, and he would be thinking of these things and possibly playing them himself. So that's MikeMalloy.com.
All right. I think we'll finish up the show here this week. I got a track from Mahalia Jackson doing Precious Lord, and it's essentially a tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King. So, till next week, Close to the Fire, we'll be here at noon.
Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on, let me stand. I am tired. Oh.